Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. The time is 9:02 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, in the Capitol Room 532. With me at the table this morning, Senator Bishop. Welcome. Hey.
Good morning, ma'am.
Senator Machicki.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Morning.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Hoffman are both excused and on other state business this morning. On today's agenda, we have a presentation from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? And for those watching who might not know, I'm co-chairman Anna McKinnon. Ms. Riddell, if you'd join us at the microphone, identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. It's a real pleasure to be with everyone this morning and to have this opportunity to walk through the Permanent Fund and the Permanent Fund Corporation. Please feel free, I know you will, to stop me at any time with questions. What I wanted to do first is I wanted to take a step back because I'm finding I've now been in this position 15 months, and I'm finding that the corporation has been around 35 years, the fund has been around 40 years, but there's a lot of misunderstandings or misperceptions as to how the fund is managed. And so I thought this would be a good time to walk through sort of the management structure, how we get to the asset allocations that we get to, and then what that means for the performance of the fund. So to start with, the corporation, as I said, was created 35 years ago in statute, and the statute is very specific that the permanent fund will be managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, and the corporation will be managed by the Board of Trustees. And the purpose of that corporation is to manage and invest the assets of the permanent fund and any other funds designated by law. And that is our only purpose, is to manage that body of financial resource for the state of Alaska. So what is this Board of Trustees that manages the corporation? There are six members. Four of the members are private citizens that have been appointed by governors over the years, and two are commissioners, one of whom must be the Commissioner of Revenue. The permanent fund should provide, is managed and invested in a manner consistent with legislative findings. And those legislative findings are as follows: that the permanent fund should provide a means of conserving revenue to benefit all generations of Alaskans, that the goal should be to maintain safety of principal first and then maximize total return, and that we should be used as a savings device to allow the maximum use of disposable income of the fund. So that corporate mission that we have is written in statute. It is to manage and invest the assets of the permanent fund. And our investment responsibilities are outlined in statute as well. The board is required to designate the types of investments, to use the prudent investor rule when designating those types of investments. Related only to an investment, the corporation may borrow money that is non-recourse to the corporation or the fund, and it must be related to an investment. And then we shall maintain a reasonable diversification among investments. Sometimes we get the question as to why don't you have 100% of the fund in an S&P passive index fund? Well, one of the reasons is, quite honestly, that the prudent investor rule requires a diversification and state statute requires a diversification of those assets. This last summer, we held a corporate retreat. The corporate retreat is designed to put together, every 5 years we put together a five-year strategic plan. That strategic plan outlines our vision, our goals, our strategic priorities for the coming 5 years. And the vision that the staff and trustees came up with, and the trustees did approve this at their board meeting in September, the adoption of this, is that our vision for the corporation is to deliver sustained, compelling investment returns as the United States' leading sovereign endowment manager, which benefits all current and future generations of Alaskans. And one of the reasons we include this concept of the U.S. leading sovereign endowment manager, which may seem sort of surprising to folks, is that we are recognized globally for our work on governance and transparency and how we invest the fund. And so the United States doesn't have a sovereign wealth fund. And many times we become the standard bearer for the United States on the world stage. And so we wanted to recognize that role in our vision. We believe that this vision reflects the statutory language and intent, as well as board and staff aspirations for the corporation and the fund. And it does emphasize maximizing returns in a fully sustainable manner. It underscores, we believe, the intention of the fund to be a perpetual resource for the state of Alaska. And it embodies the core values that the staff and the board have outlined of integrity, stewardship, and passion. So every 5 years, as required by the Board of Trustees Charter, a strategic plan is developed. And our 2017 to 2021 strategic plan was developed and reviewed and adopted by the Board of Trustees at their annual meeting in September, this past September. And four strategic priorities were identified to be pursued over the next 5 years. They take into account what we believe to be stakeholder expectations of the fund and the corporation, and it builds on that common vision for the corporation. So what are those strategic priorities that were identified? One is to gain greater control of resource allocations. The second priority is to optimize our operational processes and use of financial networks and resources, to develop our best-in-class investment management capability partnership and the geographic reach to maximize investment returns, and finally, to enhance talent and staff across the Permanent Fund Corporation. What does that talent and staff look like today? Today, we have 51 positions total. This count includes vacancies and summer internships. You'll see that the bulk of the staff is located in investments with 23 permanent full-time positions. We have 11 permanent full-time in finance, which is accounting, back office, middle office, operations, 7 permanent full-time and 2 permanent part-time in HR, administrative support, legal counsel, and then IT, and then the 2 internships. One thing to note, we are currently having, our current budget does have a vacancy rate of 7.8%, and so we are holding 6 positions vacant at this time, and we have 2 more coming vacant due to retirements in the next 2 months.
Ms. Riddell, if you could pause and stay on that slide for a moment. Sure. Questions from committee members? Ms. Riddell, you said you're holding those positions open, so we've had talks before about the difficulty and challenge sometimes to attract investors to Alaska and to the corporation. So do you have applicants that you believe could fill those positions, or are you holding them open specifically for the vacancy factor?
Madam Chair, we are holding them open due to the vacancy factor. We just brought on, just as a sort of a side story, we just brought on 3 individuals into the investments, into positions that were added 2 fiscal years ago, fiscal year 16, to be precise, when you approved that budget. And we had 91 applications from around the country, actually from around the world, because we did have some international applicants into two of those positions. So we believe our ability to recruit is definitely there. So we are holding this due to the vacancy factor.
Ms. Riddell, the vacancy factor in presenting that budget to the governor, was that at the direction of the board of directors, at the direction of the legislature? Who is asking you to hold those positions open as the first question? And then I know that you've been at this table before asking for investors and to add, and that's when we had the conversation that sometimes it's difficult to manage transition and, you know, it takes a little while to bring people on board. But can you speak to the committee and the people of Alaska about what it generates when we bring in an in-house investor versus what it costs, per se, from both perspective of in-house and out-of-state investment manager?
Yes, Madam Chair, and actually I do have a couple slides further into my presentation that I'll touch on this topic then as well. But what in-house management allows us to do is to be more nimble and flexible, but also it really does allow us to, we believe, generate additional returns to the state of Alaska, as well as reducing fees, because what having that staff here in Juneau allows us to do is, for example, in private markets, they're capable of doing due diligence that we're paying fees externally to firms outside of Alaska to do because we don't have the staff capacity. So it does create a significant fee savings, and we try to be very strategic in maximizing the value of the in-house, so really targeting people that we believe will produce the best value savings to the fund when we go to make those hires.
And I asked you, who asked you to include the base vacancy factor?
Madam Chair, that comes from the Governor's Office, from the Office of Management and Budget, because we are part of the Executive Budget Act and are required to carry a vacancy factor similar to the other departments.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Riddell, do you engage in peer comparison with other large funds like Harvard, Yale, or pension funds in terms of staff ratios, appropriate levels of staff for your particular fund's size and asset mix?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we do have some peer comparisons for fund size, so both public funds and private endowment funds that you mentioned. I don't have those statistics with me today, but we can get those to the committee. I will just give you a sense of example. Funds that manage 30 to 100 billion have on average 23 IT staff alone, and we have five. So I just want to give you a sense of where parts in on the investment staff. We'll have 23, they'll have over 100 on average. But we can get the precise statistics. So we believe we do a really good job with the staff that we have and feel really good. But it's interesting to me that so much more of the outside funds have, the other funds, our peer comparisons, have much bigger back office and support staff than we do. And it's just how they've organized and gotten their resources.
Senator Von Imhoff, followed by Senator Dunleavy, and then Senator Bishop.
Okay, thank you. Just one follow-up question then. Do you publicize those reports or those comparisons or those findings? Do you put them in your annual report? Or would you just provide them for us and it's not necessarily distributable?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, they're publicly available reports that we can make available. The Board of Trustees has used them to help inform their budgetary, when they're putting the budget together each year, that information is made available. So we're happy to share it with
Thank
the committee.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just a quick question on page six, I believe. You say take into account stakeholders' expectations. Is there a defined list of stakeholders or an understood list of stakeholders? And what would that consist of? Who would be those stakeholders?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we will get you a copy of the actual strategic plan. We identified our stakeholders as Alaskans, as our investment partners. So to the extent we're in joint ventures with other partners, they have a stakeholder relationship with us. It includes legislators, elected officials, staff, trustees. So, but probably the biggest one is Alaskans.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, Alaskans, just all Alaskans.
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you.
Ms. Rodell, that would be future Alaskans and this generation?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rodell, Typically, how long does it take to hire somebody after you've pared down, let's say, the 91, and now you've got to that point where you want to? Can you just walk me through that?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it takes us probably, I would say, about 60 days. 60 to 90 days. The recruitment, what we do on the recruitment is we leave them open. We don't have the recruitments shut down on any given date. Part of it is because just it's a recruiting style to make sure that we allow applications to get in. And then after the interview, we do team interviews. So somebody will do phone screens first to narrow down the group that we want to bring, and we'll bring two or three individuals to Juneau if they're not in Juneau to begin with, and they'll have an all-day interview, so they'll meet one-on-one with various staff. And even if you're interviewing for a private market investment position, you'll meet with public market investors, you'll meet with back office, finance, so you'll meet with different groups within the corporation as well. Once that an individual has been identified to receive an offer does go out to that person, and it probably takes, you know, people have been moving in, and so that's, but I would say that's probably the bulk of time. So when I say 60 to 90 days, it's from the time we start the recruitment to the time they're sitting at their desk and going to work, period.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy?
At ease, Madam Chair.
At ease. We're back on the record. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, just two questions for Ms. Rodell. Does the fund invest in derivatives, and if so, how?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, the fund does invest in derivatives. We don't purchase them directly, but through funds that we may own, funds may be using derivatives, and so therefore we would have an investment.
Through the Chair, so they would be incidental to the purchase of a fund?
That is correct. Through the Chair, that is correct. Thanks. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. And one last question.
Senator Dunleavy, are you going to ask or put on the record what a derivative is?
I was not going to.
Let's follow up, and then I'll ask.
Okay. Next question is, would it be possible for the legislature to modify the definition of statutory net income? In short, could statutory net income's definition be modified to eliminate the need to make legislative appropriations, inflation proofing, to the corpus?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, currently statutory net income is defined in statute, and could modifications be made to that definition to account for inflation differently? I think we can, but this is going to be really a question for the lawyers, and it's going to be up to Department of Law and Legal as to how that looks and what the comfort level is, because obviously the Constitution is very clear that all income goes to the general fund, so I can't speak for law. I would like to think, though, because we have a statutory net income definition, that we could figure a way through to make that happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Rodell, would you put on the record what a derivative is so that the people of Alaska understand the answers to Senator Dunleavy's question?
I will try, Madam Chair. A derivative is a security and instrument that you can invest in that is used, usually a portion of an investment. So it takes pieces of other investments and strips off security interests and sells them, or it may be, for example, a caller, which is you are buying insurance that that if a price of a stock goes above a certain amount, you don't get the upside, because if it goes below a certain price, you get paid on for it not to go through a floor. So it gets really convoluted really fast, but basically a derivative, and I'm sorry, I don't have a nice clean Investopedia definition for you, but they're used to hedge, generally speaking, different market movements that investors believe may happen.
Thank you, Ms. Rodell. I do want to acknowledge that Senator Gary Stevens has been with us since the start of our meeting. Senator Stevens, welcome to Senate Finance. Ms. Rodell, please continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to talk about the renewable resource. So what is it that the corporation has been managing? What does this look like for the last 35 years? And I think what's really interesting is that we have a fund value well in excess of $55 billion. And yet we've taken $29.1 billion of that, and we've saved it for future generations through saving up, building up the earnings reserve account balance, putting inflation proofing back into the corpus, and other appropriations over the years that the legislature has moved money into. We've also at the same time taken $24.3 billion and distributed it to current and past generations of Alaskans. That is through the dividend fund and the capital income fund. Many times I get asked about how do we invest in Alaska, and we've put $24.3 billion back into Alaska from this renewable resource. The fund value at the end of the fiscal year was $52.8 billion. It had principal of $44.2 billion. That included unrealized gains, and the earnings reserve account balance was $8.6 billion. Looking at how it's changed over recent years, in fiscal year 14, that principal was about $45 billion with a $6.2 billion in the earnings reserve account. and now through December 31st, 2016, that corpus is $45.1 billion, and the earnings reserve account has grown to $10.3 billion. Getting to inflation proofing, this is a deposit back into the corpus. It helps the corpus maintain its purchasing power. Since the inception of the fund 40 years ago, inflation proofing has added $16.2 billion to the corpus. Just to give you a sense, we're at this point in time where it just so happens that the royalty deposits have been about the same amount as the inflation proofing. You can see over the years that inflation proofing has varied widely based on what inflation was. In 2010, the inflation calculation was actually zero, which is why that appropriation did not happen in 2010. What does the target asset allocation look like? The bulk of the portfolio, approximately 62%, are in public markets. This is in public equities and what we call fixed income plus. The plus comes from that it includes listed REITs and listed infrastructure, so publicly traded securities that generate income, which is why we have them in the income asset allocation. The balance of the portfolio, 38%, are in private markets. Private markets include private equity, absolute return or hedge funds, real estate, private infrastructure, private credit, and what we call asset allocation strategies. These are overlay strategies that we have that might involve multiple asset classes, and we use it to manage the portfolio. The performance, so this is just short-term performance, so the last year, meaning the last calendar year 2016, the last two quarters, so July 1st through December 31st, and the last quarter, which would be October 1st through December 31st, 2016. The green bars is the total fund return. The brown bars immediately to its right is a passive index benchmark. This is a 60% public equities, 30% fixed income, and 5% real estate, and 5%, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I'm drawing a blank on what that last 5% is. It'll come to me in a moment. But in any event, we beat our benchmark, the passive benchmark, with a return of 0.3% for the last quarter. And last year, you can see we beat the benchmark 8.1% to 6.3%. The other dark brown bar is the performance benchmark, which is outlined in all that language below. So it basically takes all these public indices and combines them up into a performance benchmark that mimics the asset allocation of the permanent fund. Both these benchmarks along with the total fund return objective of inflation plus 5% are all determined by the Board of Trustees. So they set the performance benchmarks. They also set the performance benchmarks for each asset class underneath this. This is the roll-up to the total fund.
Thank you, Ms. Riddell. So when we're looking at this slide, we should take away that the leadership and investments that the fund has made for the people of Alaska were 8.10%, and that beat a peer group that you're presenting to us today. Is that fair?
Yes, ma'am.
And as we look at the change of the international and national market, and thinking specifically of consumer confidence as well as new leadership in the White House and what's happening with S&P and other ventures, do we think that from the trustees' perspective that we can maintain an 8%, or is that overly optimistic given the portfolio asset allocation now?
I think, Madam Chair, when I go to the next slide, you'll get a better sense of how that volatility that you're sensing in the markets today, and that's the challenge for us. I mean, we talk about sort of, as I point out, short term, but the permanent fund is invested for the long term. And we recognize that our first priority is to maintain safety of principal and then maximize returns. And so you're going to see on the next slide how the diversification and how it has weathered, and the diversification of the asset allocation has weathered various incidences in the financial markets over that time period. So what this does is gives you a sense of what can happen over the course of 1 year, and we went from a quarter that returned 0.3% to a total year return of 8.1%. When we look at the past 20 years, you can see a much different result. So over the last 5 years, and this is calendar year 2012, so January 1, 2012, through December 31st, 2016, that five-year period, the total fund returned 8.36%. And this beat the passive index benchmark of 6.62 by a considerable amount. And that last 5% is our treasury bills, T-bills, so the short-term cash piece of it. Over the last 10 years, so this is 2006 through 2016, you'll see the total fund return 4.92%. This is a 10-year period that included the Great Recession of 2008-2009. So you can see that while we've recovered from it arguably over the last 5 years, it takes a considerable amount of time to recover from an event like the Great Recession. And then over the last 20 years, our return has been 6.81%. And that incorporates things that happened. So this takes us back to 1996. So it's going to include the tech bubbles and things that happened in 2000.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. It would have been interesting to see the total 40-year return next to the last 20 years. Do you have any idea what that looks like, just kind of off the top of your head, or is that, could you?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I know we have it on our website, what the fund has returned since inception, what the cumulative return is, and I don't have it off the top of my head. I'm looking, Pauline doesn't have it on her either, but we will get that number to you.
Thank you.
These returns have generated statutory net income, and I think it's really important to recognize as the debate is going on that statutory net income excludes unrealized gains and losses. And this came about because in 1997, the general accounting, generally accepted accounting principles changed some of the rules for income. And income now was required for financial accounting purposes to include unrealized income. And there was a recognition that it's difficult to spend and appropriate unrealized gains and losses. So the definition of statutory net income excludes the unrealized portion and realizes that for this purpose, it's just the realized portion moved into the earnings reserve account. Over the years, you can see that the realized net income has basically been between $2 and $3 billion. This realized net income is a function of the rents and dividends, regular monthly cash flow that's coming in off of investments, and it's any gains that are made as a result of investment decisions being made by the staff at the corporation or the external fund managers. And we have never targeted a statutory net income number. We've never targeted a realized number. These decisions are all made with a view towards, is it time to sell and take chips off the table, or do we want to stay in and hold this because we think the value is going up? These are true investment decisions. They're not being made as a result of some other agenda or pressure.
We have questions, Ms. Rodin. Ms. Riddell, on the 1998 definition, is it to the fund's advantage to, does the board then make a determination to hold a loss for a while, thinking that there'll be recovery because of some outside information that the trustees are acquiring, or how often or when do you, what criteria do you use to take things off the table to move it into a loss or a realized gain?
Madam Chair, losses, it depends on the asset class. So some asset classes, like in our private markets or real estate, we may be much more patient in recouping the loss because we do believe that there are market anomalies happening that will allow that loss to be recovered. If they continue for an extended period of time, and now we're talking 2 or 3 years in this instance, we'll start marking that down and start taking some of that loss and recognizing some of that and moving it, marking it on the books. The in terms of the other public market where you're buying and selling more frequently, if things are declining in value, it's much quicker. It's going to be inside of a year that it starts to move if you don't see recovery happening. And part of it, too, is making sure that you have an understanding of where you want to put. Because if we sell, even if we take a loss, it generally means that we're going to have to reinvest somewhere else. So you book the loss, but then you still have cash you have to put to work in the asset class. And so does it make sense to take that loss, take the income, buy at lower prices, arguably, because that's what's happening, and then lower your cost basis and move up? So it depends.
The last question for this slide. As the Board of Trustees discuss asset allocation, have we been in a situation where we were cash rich in the sense that we were struggling to actually deploy the cash resources over the asset allocation?
Madam Chair, I think there have been times where we've deliberately held higher cash positions because we weren't necessarily as comfortable as we wanted to be in certain markets. And that there was a plan, and in private markets, it can take a little bit longer to deploy cash out. So our external fund managers are not allowed to hold significant cash balances, but we can internally manage that better. And so there have been times where we've been cash rich deliberately in an effort to move into other asset classes, expand other asset classes, or because we just didn't feel like it was time, the time was right to get in.
Thank you. And when I say rich, I mean above the percent that mm-hmm. has been allocated for that particular resource. Yes. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Riddell, so on slide, I'm sort of one slide ahead of you, slide 16, a little bit. I've been looking at that one. I apologize. One of the questions that I have is this slide, as well as the previous slide, your returns have been fantastic. You've exceeded your benchmarks, and I applaud you. But as we both know, past returns are no guarantee of future returns. And I see that you have improved diversification, reduced value at risk. The second point there, there appears to be some shifting of asset classes. As well as I see the gold standard of Norway, their large fund, is also changing its asset class mix. I don't want to say chasing higher returns, but they're recognizing that there perhaps has been a shift in the global investment. People are able to respond so quickly because everyone's connected to information, connected electronically, that there's been some discussion of shift going on. That when you see behavior like this with Norway and others, it gives us pause. So what are your thoughts in terms of how the future returns may look like in terms of your asset mix, in terms of planning and so forth, based on what you're seeing?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, what we're seeing is, and the shift we've taken is to move into asset classes and create more international and global exposure, because we believe that that is going to temper more of the volatility. And I can talk a little bit about it on the slide. But when we look at demographic shifts and where you expect growth, and you look at population growth, and you see what's happening, whether it's in emerging markets like India, like China, like Africa, and the need for investment and what's going to happen in those areas versus what's happening in the developed markets, whether it's the United States, Japan, what's going on with the European Union, we believe that just points to ever greater need to have a global portfolio and to have that diversification within each asset class, to not be so overly exposed to one particular market, such as the U.S. domestic equity market, and to get that diversification, because our first job is to protect principal, and our second job is to maximize returns.
Thank you. Then what is, in your opinion, the associated risk and volatility by making that investment shift?
Through the chair, we believe that we are reducing the volatility and risk by making that shift, and we're doing it through private markets. So to talk about the improved diversification, this reduction, this value at risk, just to give, for those who are unfamiliar with the concept of value at risk, we do a calculation of what the value of the fund is at risk with the asset allocation based on sort of a 1-in-20-year event. What is the amount that you would potentially lose in that scenario? And we have reduced over the 5 years through the shift of asset allocation, we have shifted that value at risk down 24% to 19%. The way we've done this primarily is through increasing our investment in private markets. So this is in private equity, private infrastructure, private credit, and this has been done primarily in the developed markets. So we don't have private market investments today in emerging markets, but we continue to look for those opportunities. That increased investment is 22 to 30%. Now, you might ask, why do private markets, why are they viewed as risk reducers? And it's because the long-term commitment of capital, they don't change in value. They don't fluctuate daily because there was a currency crisis or the Brexit vote happened, where you see big swings in a public equity portfolio. You don't see that in private market portfolios. So the volatility that comes with private markets is much lower. Where you're getting the return on private markets is because private markets are illiquid, and so you're getting a premium for that illiquidity. We can't just turn around and sell 100% of this on the turn of a dime. You have to plan out over a series of months to liquidate a private market investment, and chances are you're going to have tails that remain for multiple years in an effort to get liquidity. The reason we are comfortable tying up is because we invest into perpetuity. We're considered a very patient, long-term investor. Right? Through the chair. Getting to slide 16, I want to point out that we have beat our passive performance benchmark. And as you had seen on the previous slide, it was 8.36 versus 6.29%. That 2.07% equates to $4 billion in value. And so the point of this is that if you wanted to just put it into a computer, have a computer spit out a passive index, you would have gotten 6.29%. By having the Permanent Fund Corporation and the staff directing external managers and making investment decisions internally, we have been able to generate an additional $4 billion in value to the fund that would not be there otherwise. We've improved diversification. And then Thirdly, and also very importantly, and it goes, Madam Chair, to your previous question about in-house management, we have worked really hard to reduce our management expenses, and they have declined from 42 basis points to 29 basis points, which is a 31% reduction in management fees. This has been as manager contracts open up. We've been negotiating better terms for the fund because of the knowledge we've gained internally about how these funds should be managed, and also managing the funds directly ourselves. Of the total assets are under in-house management. The bulk are found in fixed income and real estate. I think that's because in the history, the 35 years of the corporation, these are two asset classes that we've always had. So we took those on early. We've expanded into equities, both private and public, infrastructure, hedge funds, and then we do manage our cash in-house. Over the last 10 years, so this is not a new priority for the Board of Trustees, but it is to continue to build that in-house talent because we believe it has real value to the growth of the fund. Private markets have received the most investment of talent and resources over the last couple of years.
Ms. Riddell, on that slide, if we might. Did the trustees have an ideal amount of asset allocation for management of the portfolio, internal versus external? Is there a goal? 50-50? I mean, you're close to 60-40 now of slowly bringing home the jobs into the Alaska economy. Is there a goal for trustees that we should know about?
Madam Chair, they have discussed. It's not written, but over the years they've discussed, and I can see in the minutes, that they really are sort of targeting initially a 50-50 sort of target, possibly 60-40 the other way, where 60 is in-house, 40. But at that point, it gets really because there is real value to external management as well, so we don't want to go 100% in the other direction. And so at that point, you're really starting to fine-tune. A lot of it, as you know, over the years has been dependent on the resources that they've been given to follow these priorities.
If I might follow up, Ms. Riddell, then with that in mind, in six vacancies, are the six all in the investor category?
No, Madam Chair, one of them is one of the part-time positions, and three of them are in the investments, two are back office support.
So we have three investors, and as I recall, Sordell, I've had your budget for several years, and I remember adding three or a few investors. So are those the ones that are being investor positions? So are those the ones that are being held open now in the vacancy factor that equal the 800,000 plus on a previous slide?
We received four positions in fiscal year 16 and six positions in fiscal year 17. And there's one out of that fiscal year 16 and two out of the 17 that we're holding back. Yes.
Okay. Senator Michiki?
Just curious, and I'm sure you don't have that here. I actually don't see it in the annual report. Just wondering on the difference between returns between the internal and external investors.
Through the chair, Senator Matiki, we have never tracked internal returns versus external because too often we don't have portfolios to compare, which is why we create the benchmarks. So, for example, fixed income is close to what these percentages are, the percentage of the 39%. So fixed income has 40% of the 39%. If you looked at the portfolio, though, fixed income manages in-house in excess of 90% of the portfolio. So it's almost entirely managed in-house. There's a couple of high-yield bond funds that are managed externally, and listed infrastructure, listed REITs are in their portfolio now. So they've beat their benchmarks, and we can show you how the internal management has done against their individual benchmarks, but we don't have an apples to apples of you've got this portfolio externally, the same portfolio is being managed, so we can compare your performance, which is the purpose of the benchmarks.
Senator Machicki?
Just leading toward the, if the cost of, the management cost of the external investments ultimately brings equal or greater value of the greater cost of the external investments. That's kind of what I was leading toward. I mean, do you know in your sort of in your mind and just from watching these investments that the external investment classes have outperformed the cost of the investment?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, our external managers have done really well for the fund, and we believe that they are value add and that the costs that they have are a good investment because we believe in the asset class. We have conviction in that manager's mandate. When we lose conviction, we will start to put managers on notice and move managers off. And we've moved more towards performance-driven fee arrangements so that there's more incentive compensation built into those external management contracts to benefit both of us.
Please continue. Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. It was an interesting comment you made there, and then just the antenna went up on the back of my head a little bit. So performance-based, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going, okay, are they going to get a little bit more riskier here? And that's my only.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's a really good question to ask, and that's something we watch very carefully. So even the investment staff that are responsible for managing external manager portfolios are on due diligence on a regular basis to make sure they're not engaging in riskier behavior that's outside of the mandate that we've given them and the direction we've given them on that front.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
I wanted to talk a little bit about to give the committee a sense of the real value of that in-house management. And taking something like real estate, I think, is really easy for folks to understand. So we are managing directly in the real estate portfolio $5.5 billion worth of properties. And these are under every type of property. They're multifamily, office buildings, industrial, commercial, retail. They include properties not only here in the United States, but properties in Spain, Portugal, England. So that $5.5 billion portfolio, the four individuals that are responsible for that asset class, their salaries and benefits, just salaries and benefits, cost approximately $83,333 a month. This is out of the Permanent Fund Corporation's operations budget. This isn't overhead, this isn't back office time or any of that, just their salaries. That $5.5 billion generates monthly cash flow of $21.2 million gross of fees to the fund. And that $21.2 million is going into the earnings reserve account. And this is monthly income. This is not value of property. So we're not including here that the value of the mall that was bought went from $100 million to $150 million. This is just cash flow income that then goes into other investments. And if we bought today a 30-year treasury bond at today's coupon rates of 2.875%, $5.5 billion in treasury coupon, 30-year treasury bonds would generate monthly cash flow of $13.2 million. So we are generating in excess of $8 million by managing that portfolio and having that asset class in-house and having that staff internally to manage that and generate that kind of additional income by doing that. I do like to point out, because I think people aren't necessarily aware, but we've gotten a lot of global recognition over the years as to how we manage the fund. And we've actually had a number of funds come to Juneau and to sit with staff to understand how they invest, how they think about investing, and then how, as a public fund, we create transparency and understanding with what we're doing. This past October, Pew Charitable Trust put together a report. The title of the report was From Volatile Severance Taxes to Sustained Revenue. And one of the things that they pointed out was that Alaska and the New Zealand Superfund have ensured prudent governance, monitoring, and disclosure, and they stand as examples of the best practices for sovereign wealth funds domestically or internationally. And I just wanted to point out for people that we have this recognition out there that people write in these reports that study different sovereign wealth funds, that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation and the fund itself routinely get recognized on this front. We've won two industry innovation awards in 2011 and 2013, and we routinely, as I said, host other sovereign wealth funds to meet with us and to understand how we've done it. And they range from Singapore and Norway to Mongolia to Massachusetts to the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds. So I guess if there are any key takeaways from today's meeting, it's an understanding that we've been flexible and adaptive, and we recognize that our role is changing, that the corporation is a key to the success of the fund. I think one of the reasons we're able to have the debates that are happening today is because of the successful management of the fund. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any additional questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Ms. Burden. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Hey, Chair, kind of a 30,000-foot level question, but are there any concerns that you would want to share with us as we move forward into what could be a period of time in which we call upon the permanent fund to do more for Alaska in terms of potential revenue? Any words of wisdom, anything we should keep our eye on as we move in this direction?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think that hopefully what the presentation has pointed out to the committee and anyone listening in is that we've been able to operate to date with great independence in terms of the board of really relying on a board of trustees to professionally manage this fund, to set an asset allocation which meets the goals, to not invest to any particular number, to a dividend of any kind. And so I believe and expect that that will continue under any plan that may happen. I guess I would just, if there was a cautionary note, just recognize what that role is and how you want the corporation to act going forward with any new role that may be developed.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, when you look at other funds such as the fund in Kazakhstan or Norway, over the last couple of years with the dramatic drop in oil, in which many of these countries are also dependent upon, are they approaching their funds differently now with that dramatic drop in oil than they were previous to this drop?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, you're seeing greater pressure placed on funds to become budget stabilization funds, which are very different than long-term endowment or sovereign wealth funds. And so they're having to step in and provide more resource to current short-term expenses. So, and it's the same thing that this committee is facing.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Just a little bit of a philosophical question. Your trustees, would you say are knowledgeable on the early formation of the fund and the purpose of the creation of the fund in general? I mean, have they reviewed the transcripts from the founding fathers of the permanent fund and sort of understand that, or do they separate themselves and just see themselves as a group of trustees with that are charged with maximum returns? And does it matter? Is the policy part of the understanding of the creation of the fund to transfer past resources that have an end life of production to future Alaskans in perpetuity? Is that our job, or is that something that trustees also sort of understand and think about when someday it transfers into a source of revenue for partially funding government?
Through the chair, Senator Matucci, when trustees come on board, they're given a very thorough orientation. And the history of the fund is shared with them. They're Alaskans. When I look at the current board makeup, I look at our board chair, Bill Moran. I look at Marty Rutherford. I look at Larry Cash and Carl Brady, who all have very long, deep ties in the state. They take their job as trustees and fiduciaries of the corpus of the fund very seriously. Where they sort of hit a pause button is on getting in the discussions about spending the earnings reserve account, because in their minds, that amount of money, that account, has always belonged to the state. It's always been viewed as a state spending account, and statute directed the earnings reserve account to be invested alongside the corpus of the fund. But it's available for appropriation in its entirety every year. It always has been. And I think they have experienced in the past where when taking positions has proved unpopular, it has come back to hurt the corporation at times. And so they are very cognizant that they are not politicians, that they are fiduciaries, and that their job is to protect, as is mine, is to protect the fund and not to weigh into the political debate about how the earnings reserve account should or should not be used.
Senator Matucci.
So probably a key takeaway from this is the only difference they're going to see, and no matter how they feel individually, the takeaway they're going to see is that perhaps changes in investment philosophy associated with the use of the earnings reserve for government funding for the first time. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, Senator Matucci, that is exactly right.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Through the chair, so Ms. Riddell, just to address a couple remarks. From what I can tell, I don't see any conversations regarding addressing the independent governance of the permanent fund. I think that's, as far as I can tell, this is Natasha speaking, I think that's going to remain intact. That's not the conversations I'm hearing. And in terms of a long-term view as an endowment, I think that there's a been discussion of having a predictable, a stable source of revenue versus a grab for any number of amounts. So I think that having those two, what I'm looking at is, our question from you is, looking on slide 3, your third bullet, considering the bills that are in play now and the conversations that I'm sure that your board is aware of, what is your opinion a good place to land for the maximum use of an annual income draw, looking at a long-term predictable endowment type of model?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, all the numbers, all the ranges are reasonable, and we don't take an opinion as to what the right number is or what the draw should be.
All the numbers presented now are reasonable.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, all of the proposals in all of the bills that are currently both in this body and in the body on the other side of the building, there have been many different proposals. They range from, I believe, 4.5% to 5.25% draw amounts. So all of those range, all of those different draw amounts, my only statement to them is that they're all reasonable draw amounts.
Thank you.
Ms. Burdell, you're choosing your words carefully, and I appreciate that because you report to a board of directors, and you certainly receive guidance from the governor of Alaska. Senator Hoffman has stated on the record for many of the conversations that we're having around the current position in the fiscal structure of the state. And I would just remind all of us that for multiple years now, we have drawn $3 billion plus from our savings accounts, and we have a structural deficit. And for some of us, we've waited for five, almost 6 years now to advance a proposal to touch the earnings reserve account. I would say, I believe I'm saying safely, that there isn't a single legislator that's currently elected or previously elected that would relish the idea of using the earnings reserves. But given the state that we've drawn down over $10 billion draws for the last 6 years, it's becoming increasingly important that we are losing assets that could be providing returns. And if we don't have those assets in the bank, we've already seen a $200 million loss of returns that could be that could ask Alaskans to pay in the form of taxation because the reserves are not in the savings accounts to turn any longer. And so you chose your words carefully, and I'm trying to get to that. You're an Alaskan, even if you may have been here a shorter term than I've been here. And you talk about stabilization versus endowment. And I would pose a little bit different look in that we're at a crossroads. That's been used before. But we're also looking for the assets that we've saved over the course of 40 years, that rainy day account that Governor Hammond spoke about, that after 6 years of waiting, that it may be time to access, for a limited period of time at least, use of those to try to stabilize a recession that Alaska is heading into. And so, you know, we're reaching out to the corporation and the Board of Trustees about the issue of bridging the state to a stabler future and stabilizing that foundation. So setting aside the value or the rate of returns that we should be looking at, you have pointed to particular issues that might stabilize the use of not the use, but the actions that the board needs to take to ensure your number one and number two goal. And that number one goal for all of us and everything that I've seen is the safety of the principle of the corpus of the fund for all generations of Alaska, both those that are born today and those that would be born off into the future that will become Alaskans. And we're all looking at allowing maximum return. And so you've spoken to that on allow maximum use on this slide 3 of disposable income from the fund for purposes. Is there specific characteristics inside of any of the bills that are heading our way for conversation that allow you that flexibility? So that's the first question. And the second is that I participated in meetings last year where the trustees got together and reviewed all the proposals out there. They did not take action. So for those Alaskans that are following at home, the Board of Trustees very much does not want to be in the politics of this issue. Their role is to safeguard the principle of the permanent fund and to maximize the earnings from that rainy day account. Ms. Rodell, will you be, so the second question is, will the board be reviewing this year's actions, and if so, when?
Madam Chair, the first question about the bills and protecting the corpus and maximizing budget stabilization, I think it's important to note that when we talk about a budget stabilization fund, if you think about it as a glide path down to a new a new revenue balance. So when we talk about a budget stabilization fund or using these funds as budget stabilization, generally what people are assuming is that you're drawing on it for a limited period of time until you've been able to hit that reset of revenue equaling expenditures. And that's very different than an endowment where you are going to be a revenue source for every year going forward, when you think about it, because there's no end to that endowment type. So when you talk about different numbers and budget stabilization versus endowment, it becomes important that you recognize when the end period is and that you may need to draw more today while you're getting down to that new reality. But what is the intent going forward? Is it to continue to use the fund on an ongoing basis into perpetuity to fund a portion of state government? And so that's the sort of the debate and what we look at from the investment management. If we're now having to move investments in the earnings reserve account into more short-term, very liquid type investments because the budget stabilization factor is at play and you're going to use all of that within 5 years, that adjustment will be made versus, but recognize that then that amount is not generating 8%, 6.95%, 6% returns. It's generating 2% returns type returns on that portion of the money. So that's why it's important to understand sort of what is it that the earnings reserve account is going to do and what it's being used for and how it goes forward. So, and the bills are very different that way. Some of the bills have, mechanisms to cut it off after it builds up a balance up to a certain point, or if oil revenues reach a certain point. And so there's different mechanisms being considered and discussed, which leads me to the second question you had about the trustees evaluating the bills. When the trustees did it a year ago, it was at the request of the trustees, and there was a lot less information at the time. The trustees have not asked for that to happen again this year. I think in part because we started sort of where we ended last year on some of the bills, and so some of that was already modeled. I think that if the bills move and get more legs and get more solid, for lack of a better descriptor, the trustees may reconsider that. They have a board meeting this week, and I know it will probably be a topic of discussion as to whether or not they want to order that to happen. So.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the subject of liquidity, how does the Board of Trustees in the last several years, and we had a healthier constitutional budget reserve balance and we're managing unnecessarily for liquidity and essentially cost the state literally billions in investment opportunity, has the Board of Trustees been frustrated with that? I mean, do they have suggestions of when we get back to a healthy fund balance in the constitutional budget reserve? You've been in those meetings. Have they talked about, boy, would rather manage that for greater returns as well, particularly when it had a more static balance for several years, as opposed to the state management back then, not today, of course, but back then, just an unnecessary consideration of liquidity that was not going to be tapped? Is that something that the, if and when we get back to those days, shouldn't the permanent fund be managing all of our somewhat stable savings, such as the constitutional budget reserve, for a greater return?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Putting on my old, haven't worn it in quite some time now, my Commissioner of Revenue hat, and I was a trustee of the Permanent Fund, I will tell you that it never, when I was a trustee, it never was discussed about whether or not any of the funds should be managed. And I think that having the Commissioner of Revenue on both as the fiduciary for the state funds and on the board for the trustees, there is a continuity or a consistency of application that happens, because as the Commissioner of Revenue, you're in the one seat where you see all the funds. You see the PERS and TERS trust funds and how they're being managed and what's happening in those buckets. You know what's going on with the state, whether it's the Constitutional Budget Reserve or the state general funds and the cash management and how all of that's being managed and invested. And you have the Permanent Fund that you're a trustee to as well. So as the Commissioner of Revenue, you end up in a really unique and valuable position of seeing the entire financial portfolio. So I think that the Treasury Division in particular does a yeoman's job in managing the cash that moves in and out daily, and especially right now when revenues don't meet the targets in the last couple of years, and needing that reserve in a very liquid form to be able to address, because payroll for the state gets made the 15th and the last day of every month, and taxes may only come in once or twice. And so managing through what can be a very different revenue picture versus how the expenditures get made is very valuable. And if all that money is being managed over at the fund, you've now created another layer where cash management is having to pull off and coordinate basically like with yet another external bank. And I don't think that's the intent or the desire. And I think the Constitutional Budget Reserve had to be managed in a much more conservative fashion than the fund, because at the end of the day, you were relying on that $3 billion to be there to fund up the budget deficit each year that you've drawn out. So you've drawn out $10 billion out of the last 4 or 5 years, Madam Chair, if I remember correctly. And if that had been invested, you know, out in really volatile investments like the fund or in the illiquids of the fund, you wouldn't have had that. So I, with all due respect, Senator Machicki, I think it was prudent and it was correct.
Senator Machicki.
I just want to remind you that I separated the question between when those funds were needed to run government. I mean, it was an impending withdrawal and relatively stable times. I mean, I think there's a way to separate those two for better performance if we get back in that position. And we probably won't be having that conversation for several years now, but I did separate them quite clearly, and I agree with you about the last 4 or 5 years. I'm just thinking about when you have a fully funded CBR and things are more stable. It seems like that lost opportunity has been expensive.
Senator Dunleavy.
The Chair, Senator, you said something I thought that was significant. Well, you said a lot of things that were significant, but in this particular case, rainy day account would indicate that the rain stops raining someday. In other words, it's a temporary approach to dealing with a temporary issue. Mm-hmm. And the endowment concept indicates that it is a shift that becomes permanent. Depending upon what this legislature decides, whether it is in fact a rainy day account, which means it's a temporary bridging or get through the rain, or whether it's an endowment, will that have Will that have, and to what degree would that have an impact on your investment strategies going forward?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think that if it's the endowment, the ongoing, there will be very little shift in the investment strategy because while we don't manage to a dividend today, we do deliver a certain percentage. It's a smaller percentage. I think if you looked at the dividend transfer each year, it would come out to be about a POMV of 1.5 to 2%, roughly back of the envelope math. And so, you know, we've sort of have this concept where you're drawing out a percentage of the fund's value and distributing it in the form of dividends over years. We don't manage it to a liability. We don't say, oh, we need to generate X billion dollars. It just so happens that when we look back and look at what the math looks like, it's roughly that average. When we talk about whether it's a rainy day fund, then I believe the asset allocation may have to shift, and it goes back to that point about making sure that there is cash and liquidity when it's expected, because many of the bills that I have seen do take a 5-year of the previous 6-year look back. So it's walking in to the first day of session and saying, you have X billion dollars already banked for the coming fiscal year, and you start from that as opposed to having sort of a volatile or unknown revenue expectation. You're still going to have some of that from the other revenue sources that you are looking to fund state government, and I guess that's sort of the other key, is that we don't want to be in a position of being the only taxpayer, so to speak, the only funder of state government, because that is going to be a very uncomfortable place to be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Ms. Rodell, thank you for joining us today. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to, sorry, I kind of jumped in there and cut you off, but I thought you did a great job of walking a tightrope today.
Senator Michiki.
Ms. Rodell, before we leave, I just, so we talked about the POMV model, but 128 had a max draw where it would limit. So it's a combination of rainy day and an endowment model, right? How do you feel about that kind of mechanism? Where how does that look from a management perspective when things start catching up and the draw is reduced? Does that look a little different than a 5.25 flat?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I think it does create some management flexibility because you'll know that you'll never exceed a certain dollar amount for liquidity purposes. But I have to go back and look. I haven't looked at 128 in a while as to how that cap worked or when it kicked in. But it does a little bit. I mean, part of the value in having the 5 out of 6, like I said, is we're going to have some certainty because we're going to know when we close the books on June 30th what the draw, and so that'll give us basically a year to plan for that draw amount on July 1st of the start of the new fiscal year.
Ms. Rodell, when you're referring to 128, you're referring to a piece of legislation that was advanced by the Senate Finance Committee to the Senate floor and then passed across to the other body that died there. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate? It was use of the earnings in the last legislative cycle.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Michiki.
So this year we're also talking about a spending limit to capture the upper end. I mean, we had a max draw, and then we're working on controlling what can be spent in the future as well. And I just think those two processes somewhat protect your effort to produce maximum returns to the state, and it defines that when things do turn around, that we don't plan on increasing the available revenue to increase the spend as well. We don't have a bill to look at, so largely it's philosophical, but I hope that the permanent fund folks see this as a protecting your responsibility for maximum returns and not sort of opening the spigot to available revenue that none of us want to see grow dramatically. We just want to be able to pay our bills today.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Machicki. Ms. Riddell, the limit that was included in the SB 128 that was referred to a moment ago had a spending limit of 1.2 or a draw limit of $1.2 billion, and then precipitously dropped with increases in revenue from other sources, I believe on a dollar-per-dollar basis, mm-hmm. is what Senator Machicki and Ms. Riddell were referring to. With that, anything else to come before the committee? Tomorrow on the agenda, we'll have the operating budget. We'll be hearing from the Department of Transportation at 9 a.m., and at 1:30, we have bills before us, SB 21, talking about the issue that we're discussing this morning, as well as SB 26. Both bills relate to the permanent fund. With that, we're adjourned.